The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's Thursday the 28th of August. I'm Claire Catford. On today's podcast, former US President Bill Clinton speaks at the Democratic Convention.
Everything I learned in my 8 years as president has convinced me that Barack Obama is the man for this job.
Miliband in Ukraine to form coalition against perceived Russian aggression.
So far, it's game set and match to Russia. And really, if the best Britain can do is throw David Miliband at a problem, then, you know, I don't think we're going to get very far.
Despite the economic gloom and doom, we are happier than ever. Honest.
The way you have to look at it is that unhappiness is the gap between what you expect to have in life and what you actually do have to bring your expectations into line with reality, with what you do have to achieve a kind of contentment.
But first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
For the first time, Bill Clinton has given Barack Obama his full support to become America's next president. The former president and husband of Obama's main rival, Hillary Clinton, said he is the man for the job. Senator Joe Biden formally accepted the nomination to run as vice president. And there's more to come from the Democratic convention in Denver later on Guardian Daily. At least 8 people have been killed by an explosion in northwest Pakistan. Police say a bomb hit a van carrying prisoners in the town of Banu, but it's not yet clear if it was a suicide attack. There have been a string of suicide bombings and gun attacks since the threat of impeachment forced Pervez Musharraf to resign as president last week. Ministers from the G7 industrialized nations have issued a joint statement condemning Russia's recognition of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The group deplores Moscow's excessive use of military force and its continued occupation of parts of Georgia. Foreign Secretary David Miliband, speaking in Kiev yesterday, said of the Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, "We don't want a new Cold War. He has a big responsibility not to start one." Ken Livingston, the former mayor of London, will become an advisor to the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez. During a surprise visit to Caracas, Livingston said he would act as a consultant on the capital's policing, transport and other municipal issues. He said he believes Venezuela's capital, Caracas, will become a first world city in 20 years. In football, Arsenal and Liverpool have reached the group stages of the Champions League. Arsenal thrashed FC Twente 4-0 to win 6-0 on aggregate. Liverpool needed extra time, but their 1-0 win against Standard Liège following a goalless first leg. You can follow the draw for the next round live at 4:30 p.m. BST at guardian.co.uk/football. Now for a look at today's papers and many carry reports of the missing family feared dead after their house on the Welsh borders was deliberately burnt down. The businessman has debts of £2 million, says The Telegraph. The Independent reports that cabinet ministers will give Gordon Brown one last chance to save his premiership, but will try to oust him by November if he fails to improve Labour's prospects. In the FT, there's news that Microsoft have released a web browser that includes a feature that could affect the advertising model of internet rivals such as Google. The private mode lets users access websites without disclosing their browsing habits, which websites need to be able to deliver targeted ads. The Express is outraged by what they call the green tax con that costs you an average of £783 a year through Gordon Brown's bogus taxes. The Sun, meanwhile, has news that 18 crewmen on a Royal Navy warship have tested positive for taking Class A drugs. On the back pages, plenty of speculation that Sean Wright Phillips is to become a Manchester City player once more, and Liverpool captain Steven Gerrard will miss England's opening World Cup qualifiers. He needs surgery on a groin injury. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Now we cross live to our team at the Democratic Convention in Denver.
This is Ewan McCaskill, just come out of the convention centre after a surprise night in which we heard a sensational speech by President Bill Clinton, reminding us how just what a great speaker he'd been.
A President Obama will choose diplomacy first and military force as a last resort. People the world over have always been more impressed by the power of our example than by the example of our power.
Well, Joe Biden was unlucky that he had to follow a speech as good as that, and that Biden didn't quite rise to the same heights, but it was still he did what Barack Obama wanted him to do, which is be the attack dog against John McCain.
I profoundly disagree with the direction John wants to take this country, from Afghanistan to Iraq, from Amtrak to veterans. You know, John thinks that during the Bush years, quote, we've made great economic progress. I think it's been abysmal. And in the Senate, John has voted with President Bush 95%, and that is very hard to believe. That's not change. That's the same.
And then to top it all, Barack Obama came out at the end.
The change is brought about because ordinary people do extraordinary things. And so we want to open up this convention to make sure that everybody who wants to come can join in the party and join in the effort to take America back. I think we are going to have a great night tomorrow night, and I look forward to seeing you there. God bless you.
There was a feeling earlier today that the convention had gone badly, the infighting with the Clintons, they weren't criticising John McCain. And then in the space of a few hours, because of those speeches, it's all turned round, and we're seeing the shift and move towards the party reunifying.
He has a remarkable ability to inspire people, to raise our hopes and rally us to high purpose. He has the intelligence and curiosity every successful president needs. His family heritage and his life experiences have given him a unique capacity to lead our increasingly diverse nation in an ever more interdependent world.
There was a feeling that Hillary Clinton hadn't really addressed the issue of Obama's character in her speech. She offered fulsome support, but there was some carping criticism that she didn't go far enough and say that actually he would be a good president. Bill Clinton did that job tonight. He was lavish in his praise of Barack Obama. He just heaped plaudit upon him, saying, you know, all those questions suggesting he's not fit to be commander-in-chief, it's just not true.
16 years ago, you gave me the profound honor to lead our party to victory and to lead our nation to a new era of peace and broadly shared prosperity. Together, we prevailed in a hard campaign in which the Republicans said I was too young and too inexperienced to be commander-in-chief. Sound familiar? It didn't work in 1992 because we were on the right side of history. And it will not work in 2008 because Barack Obama is on the right side of history.
At the end of his speech, he spoke about how he'd come from the town of hope, and that sort of tied in to Barack Obama's talk about, you know, the dream, restoring the American dream. So it was a neat way of bringing together the Clinton and potential Barack Obama presidency. It was almost as if Clinton was anointing his successor.
Barack Obama will lead us away from the division and fear of the last 8 years back to unity and hope. So, if, like me, you believe America must always be a place called hope, then join Hillary and Chelsea and me in making Barack Obama the next president of the United States. Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you. One of the question marks about Barack Obama is whether he has enough experience in foreign policy. With Joe Biden there, That argument falls away. You know, Biden's been doing this for decades. So when he says George Bush's foreign policy isn't working and John McCain's plans aren't working, then it has a credibility that they wouldn't have coming from most other senators.
I've been on the ground in Georgia, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and I can tell you in no uncertain terms, this administration's policy has been an abysmal failure.
One strength that Joe Biden has is his working-class background. So that can help dilute criticism that Barack Obama is too elitist. and he played a lot in that. He was this sort of working class boy from Scranton, Pennsylvania, spoke about his father and his relatively modest upbringing, and he spoke about American values.
I know why I'm here. I'm here for everyone I grew up with in Scranton and Wilmington. I'm here for the cops and the firefighters, the teachers and the assembly line workers, the folks whose lives are the very measure of whether the American dream endures. Millions of Americans have been knocked down. And this is a time, as Americans together, we get back up. These are extraordinary times. This is an extraordinary election. The American people are ready. I am ready. Barack is ready. This is his time. This is our time. This is America's time. God bless
America. Tonight we'll see a sort of change of pace. For the last 19 months of the campaign, Barack Obama has given us a sort of high-blowing, high-flowing rhetoric, which is terrific to hear. But lots of people said they lacked substance. So tonight, Obama said in recent days, he's going to dilute the high-blown rhetoric and will focus on substance, especially the economy, which is the number one issue that concerns America. People want to know what he's going to do about jobs, what he's going to do about petrol prices, what he's going to do about the lost homes, and I think that's what he's going to do. In spite, although he says it's going to be a sort of nuts and bolts speech, I don't think that's entirely possible. Not only have we the historical appointment of the first black Democratic presidential candidate, this is taking place on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, so there's no way that this speech is going to be anything other than very, very emotional, at least at the start, if you, and maybe Obama will subsequently go into his more nuts and bolts mode.
And for more analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/US elections 2008. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, James Richardson and the pod chew over last night's Champions League action in Football Weekly. Find that at guardian.co.uk/football. Have you ever boycotted a restaurant because of the way it treats its staff? That's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/food. And what's going to be new in Microsoft's Windows 7? That's at guardian.co.uk/technology. UK Foreign Secretary David Miliband is meeting leaders in Ukraine for talks on forming a coalition against perceived Russian aggression. He's meeting leaders at Kiev after Russia formally recognised the independence of Georgia's two breakaway regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Ukraine's leaders believe that the brief war between Georgia and Russia has exposed serious weaknesses in the powers of the UN and other international bodies. Luke Harding is The Guardian's Moscow correspondent. I asked him why David Miliband was in Ukraine in the first place.
Well, that's a very good question, but I think David Miliband is trying to make a point that after Russia's sort of successful invasion of Georgia, that Ukraine could be next. Now, Ukraine has a huge Russian-speaking population. The east of the country is basically Russian. You hear Russian on the streets all the time. And Crimea, where Russia keeps its Black Sea fleet, is also a very kind of pro-Russian, Russian-dominated enclave. And, of course, the fear is after Georgia that, you know, that Ukraine could be the next country to come into the Kremlin's sort of hairlines.
What about the West's strategy now in the light of what's happened between Russia and Georgia? Real fear that the West has no influence or very little influence at all.
Well, it doesn't. And having spent 2 weeks in Georgia, I mean, the West doesn't really seem to have much of a strategy. I mean, the Kremlin has basically invaded a sovereign nation. And, you know, what's happened? Well, not much. And the West has sort of talked about various sanctions, you know, like kind of suspending cooperation with NATO, like stopping Russia from joining the World Trade Organization. But frankly, the Kremlin, you know, is hopping around dancing and laughing. It doesn't really care at all about this. President Medvedev, in an interview with the BBC, has been very insouciant about the prospect of a new Cold War. And really, so far, it's game, set and match to Russia. And really, if the best Britain can do is throw David Miliband at a problem, then, you know, I don't think we're going to get very far.
The president said that a Cold War could not be ruled out, but that his country didn't want one. There are no winners in a Cold War. Was that posturing, or do you think there was some truth behind that?
I have to admit that as someone who lives in Moscow, I'm rather cynical about what the Kremlin says. I mean, they say very often one thing publicly and And, you know, the reality is often very different. I think Russia is on a roll. I think the Kremlin leadership are euphoric. They've staged this major military adventure in Georgia and got away with it. There have been no great consequences, no great punishment for them. They can still, you know, holiday in Western Europe, go skiing, you know, keep their properties in London. You know, no one's talked about ending any of that. And I think, more seriously, I think what Russia is trying to do is to try and reassert its kind of Soviet influence and kind of change the narrative of the Cold War. Everyone in the West thought that Russia had lost the Cold War. Putin doesn't think Russia lost the Cold War. And he's now, basically, what he wants to do is to restore Soviet space, restore Soviet influence over the countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union, which are now independent.
One of the intriguing points to all of this, because of the recent oil crisis, is that so much of Europe's oil comes from Russia. Yet in the last Cold War, that didn't affect the supply. Do you think that's in the minds of those who are negotiating at the minute?
I think it very much is. I mean, before we go too far down this Cold War road, we have to remember that there's no great kind of ideological difference between the West and Russia. I mean, you know, the Russian leadership are capitalists. They're extremely wealthy. They have bank accounts in Switzerland. They're integrated into the global economy. And in a sense, they don't want to go so far that they start losing their money and having their bank accounts frozen. So that's kind of one difference. I think additionally to that, you know, we just have to wait and see how far they go. I think Ukraine is a big country. It's much bigger than Georgia. And I think trying to do Ukraine... Oh, by the way, the rumour is that they'll do London after Ukraine, but trying to do Ukraine would be quite tough.
And you can find out more on the tension between Russia and the West at www.guardian.co.uk/world. I'm Claire Catford, still to come in today's Guardian Daily. Please don't cut short our lives. Kidney cancer sufferers protest against drug decision.
Well, I've got advanced kidney cancer. At the moment, I'm not being treated. They say there's nothing they can treat me with. Sutent is the best drug in the world. It's available in Turkey, Romania, Western European countries. It's known to extend life for at least 2 years. Without that, we're goners, I'm afraid. There is nothing else.
But first, police and firefighters have been waiting to search the gutted remains of a millionaire's mansion after it was set ablaze by arsonists. It's feared that Christopher Foster, his wife and their 15-year-old daughter may have died in the attack. The fire swept through their £1.2 million home at Maysbrook in Shropshire, causing extensive damage. Investigators won't be able to search the house until it's been checked by structural engineers. The Guardian's senior reporter Ian Cobain has been following the story. I asked him whether it had been confirmed that the blaze was started deliberately.
It was an arson attack, and several buildings were badly damaged. There was the main house occupied by this family was damaged, along with several outbuildings. In one outbuilding and a stable, two of the family's horses were found to have died. It's not clear as yet, and it's not clear to me whether they died as a result of the fire or whether they were killed before the fire was set, but certainly it's a very deliberate attack on this property, on this house, and upon the outbuildings. There have been reports, in addition, which haven't been confirmed by the police, which is that there were attempts to prevent firefighters from gaining access to the property by parking a horse box across the gate, the entrance gate, and puncturing the tyres, but the police won't confirm whether or not this is the case.
This all sounds quite mysterious. Christopher Foster was a millionaire by the time he was 30. He drove two Porsches and an Aston Martin. And there seems to be some confusion as to the state of his businesses, some shadow, if you like, over what exactly was going on.
Well, he told a couple of the neighbours and friends recently that he was feeling the pinch because of the credit crunch. He had, as you said, made a substantial amount of money while still in his 20s by developing insulation technology, which was used in the offshore oil industry. But it's now apparent that one of his main companies, which is a company called Alba Limited, went into liquidation last year. It was wound up compulsorily. What the problems were with that company, we don't know. We don't know. The administrator isn't telling us. But clearly he was experiencing some financial problems. He'd also, his home was burgled in 2006, and a number of neighbours have said that that members of the family had explained that burglary, they believed, was the result of a vendetta which was in some way connected with Mr. Foster's business career.
And we don't know exactly whether or not his wife and child, and of course the man himself, are still alive, even though there are suspicions that they may not be.
No, we don't. We don't. Obviously, a lot of people are hoping that they were not inside the building and are safe and well, but they haven't come forward to explain where they are, to explain where their whereabouts are. And there are a number of police officers who fear the worst, frankly. They fear that when they are able to get inside the building, that they will find, they may find, the body of one or more of the members of this family.
Ian Cobain reporting.
From Guardian.co.uk, this is Guardian Daily.
Dozens of kidney cancer sufferers and their families have been protesting over the refusal to allow patients treatment on the NHS. NICE, that's the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, has issued draft guidance rejecting drugs that could extend a sufferer's life. This comes after NICE backed the decision for patients in England suffering from a disease which causes blindness to get new sight-restoring drugs. The organisation says the drugs for kidney cancer sufferers are not cost-effective. The Guardian's Peter Walker has been with the protesters.
Well, I've got advanced kidney cancer. At the moment, I'm not being treated. They say there's nothing they can treat me with. Sutent is the best drug in the world. It's available in Turkey, Romania, Western European countries. It's known to extend life for at least 2 years. Without that, we're goners, I'm afraid. There is nothing else.
It's absolute rubbish. I mean, you only have to look at me to see that they work. It's proven over time and time again that these drugs work. There is clinical evidence. They are not experimental drugs. They've been fully trialled. And for the vast majority of kidney cancer patients, they give us an extension to our lives and an improved quality of life.
Seeing my mum nearly die in front of me and how hard it was as a family to come together and come to the face the fact that she might not be here in a few months. To have someone turn around and say that these drugs aren't cost effective is absolutely ridiculous. It saves some, well, doesn't save a life, but it prolongs it. Those few extra months are crucial. Like, my mum's been canoeing with me the past week, and it just shows how much these drugs can actually help people.
Well, if they don't fund, well, I'll die. So will a lot of these people too, if they can't have the drug. All right, might not help me, might not. But at least I've tried it now, but it does help others, and I'm doing it for other people as well as myself.
Peter Walker joins us now. Peter, obvious reasons, feelings running very high.
Yes, there was a lot of people at the protest who actually have got terminal renal cancer and were very, very ill. There's some people who did look very, very sick, and they do believe that these drugs are their only hope. These drugs are not going to cure them, but they're going to give them, they believe, at least 6 months and possibly a lot more of life. And they want to spend that time, you know, saying goodbye to their families, doing things that they want to do, things like that.
And they have the support of a number of consultants as well who say that those drugs should be available on the NHS as well.
It's a tricky situation because a lot of the leading cancer experts, 26 of them wrote a letter to the Sunday Times at the weekend saying that they believe that NICE has got the decision wrong. They believe that their largely financial method of working out whether a drug should be used is a bit of a blunt way of doing it. However, NICE says that it hasn't got a limitless pot of money. Some drugs simply are just too expensive to use.
This comes also after NICE backed the decision for patients in England suffering from a disease which causes blindness to get sight-restoring drugs. So there appears to be some kind of inconsistency, doesn't there?
The people with renal cancer certainly feel that way, but NICE argue that their decision to not allow the sight-saving drug was correct, and they were only able to change it because they reached this unique deal with a drugs company, which means that they can get a much cheaper program of treatment. And essentially the only hope for the renal cancer patients is that one of the drugs giants who makes these four drugs might reach a similar deal with NICE.
Otherwise, they have to go private and pay thousands of pounds, presumably.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that the consultants mentioned in their letter to the Sunday Times was that people are remortgaging homes and things like that. But NICE argues that it makes the same decision on every single drug. And they do also stress that over the last 9 years, they have dealt with 56 separate cancer drugs and have approved 52 of them. And it is purely a matter of the fact that these drugs don't cure people. They merely make their life slightly longer. And they cost an enormous amount of money.
What about this kind of dilemma repeating and repeating and repeating again as more drugs become available?
NICE are saying that the decisions they make are, I think the quote was, the toughest in public life. And it's a very, very difficult thing for them. And I imagine we're going to see in future years many more similar protests. But their argument is very, very clear that the NHS only has a certain budget and not every drug which is available and on the market can be used.
Peter Walker with protesters who want drugs for kidney cancer sufferers available on the NHS.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now, apparently, we are happier than we were 25 years ago. That's according to a new report. The survey says that since 1981, despite current gloomy economic and climate prospects, happiness has risen in 45 countries. Democracy, stable communities and more liberal societies appear to influence our happiness levels. Roberto Foer is part of the team who compiled the report. I asked him who was top and who was bottom in the happiness stakes.
Countries in Western Europe do very well, in particular countries in Scandinavia, in terms of doing being at the top. Also, a number of countries in Latin America do surprisingly well, given their level of economic development. In terms of who's at the bottom, there's really no big surprises. A lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that we've surveyed recently do fairly badly. Tanzania, Rwanda, very, very, very poor countries. Also, we found that relative to economic development, certainly countries in Eastern Europe do worse than you would expect.
Interestingly enough, just because you have had more economic prosperity doesn't necessarily make you happier. I mean, China, for example, seems to be getting unhappier, says your report, despite its economic growth spurt.
That's sort of what we found. I would be more qualified in talking about China. I think time will tell. I mean, we have about 10 to 15 years now of data from our surveys for China, and I would say that it's pretty trendless fluctuation right now. But we can't predict what the next 5 to 10 years will bring.
What I think is also very intriguing is that countries that have a greater sense of community and family connection, as opposed to the highly individualistic, materialistic Western countries, if you like, the community countries have a very high rate of happiness, don't they?
Yeah, that is true. That is true. You know, basically, the way you have to look at it is that unhappiness is the gap between what you expect to have in life and what you actually do have. Throughout human history, there have always been, I would say, two strategies for maximizing your happiness. One of those is to bring your expectations into line with reality, with what you do have, to achieve a kind of contentment. And so the classic strategies for doing that are through spirituality, through your religious life, and, like you say, through your family, through your community ties. The other strategy, if you will, is to expand the freedoms that you have, the economic freedom, the political freedom, the social freedoms that you have. Now, there are a number of societies that have done better in that first strategy, and I think the societies of Latin America certainly are societies that stand out in that regard, that have stronger family lives, have stronger community lives, and where people have attained a level of happiness that is above what you would expect simply as a result of their economic development, which, if you will, is that part of that second strategy.
Previous surveys have suggested that economic happiness does not, or economic prosperity does not bring happiness, and that most of the West are on antidepressants, and that's a real problem, as possibly our expectations don't match our realities. But human beings are funny, aren't they? Because, of course, they're not just little material objects, depending on your philosophy. There's a whole lot more to being human than just what you own and what you wear.
Yes, that's absolutely true. A lot of previous studies have looked largely at economic factors, and of course they've found this initially surprising finding that, you know, for fairly rich societies at least, for those for which we have very long time series data, in Britain, the United States and so on, that, you know, the increase in wealth of the last 50 years for those societies hasn't really led to a big payoff in terms of well-being. But I think the story is a little bit more nuanced. I think what it is that, you know, it's really a case of diminishing returns, that beyond a certain threshold, economic gains don't give you returns for your happiness, but they do under a certain threshold. So when you look at the societies, like I was saying, a number of societies in Africa are very unhappy. When you look at those poor to medium income societies, it's a pretty good correlation actually with your level of what you have, your material goods. But beyond that point, the relationship really breaks down, and it becomes a question of all those other aspects that make you who you are as a person, that give you the opportunity to become who you want to be in life, and that's always a question of your social freedoms, your political freedoms. It becomes a much more complicated story.
Researcher Roberto Foer with his thoughts on what makes us happy in the 21st century.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
I'm Ben Green. It's another baking hot day in Denver at the DMC. And I'm here with another slice of life from beyond the convention floor. Now, everyone here is rightly getting pretty excited about Barack Obama's headline speech later on tonight. It's an address that'll go some way to determining whether he makes it all the way to the White House or not. But what about the current incumbent? Well, earlier I caught up with a self-styled raging granny, and she had this message for George W. Bush.
Hi, my name's Nancy Taylor, and I'm on the Capitol steps, in front of the Capitol steps in Denver, Colorado, at an anti-war rally. But I'm a raging granny. It's a singing group. What we do is sing social and political commentary to familiar tunes. And some of us were supposed to be here today. I'm here. I don't know what happened to the others, but we're going to be out there and telling it how it is in song.
Can you give me a sneak preview of the song? Can you do it by yourself?
Oh, sure. One of our favorites is Goodbye, W. We'll say goodbye, W. We won't cry, W. You'll be going back to Texas. We can't wait. It's been hell, W, so farewell, W. With the help of Congress, you'll be out the gate. Here's adios to you, sub your nose to you. Take your greedy lion chums along the way. Hey, impeach him in the House, Congress. He's a louse, Congress. Back to Texas, never to. Back to Texas, never to. Back to Texas, never to return.
Well, there you go, a raging granny indeed. But it really is all about the Obama show later on. Our election team will bring you full analysis on Guardian Daily tomorrow morning, and you can read more online at guardian.co.uk/America.
Ben Green with one of the more colourful contributors to the Democratic Convention. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Peter Sale and Phil Maynard. I'm Claire Catford. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.